So welcome to Leverage Podcast. I have no idea what call this is. Somewhere between fucking 30 and 50. We're really, organized.
We're really organized
around here.
Well, we know what we're doing. Organized.
Organization was never the strong suit. So, okay. I have my best friend in the whole wide world on the call. I was the best man at his wedding, and I think I'm going to get to be the best man at his wedding again soon. I sucked the first time around, so I'll see if I can do a little better job. And we're going to be talking about some personal finance stuff today, because technically you are, a financial planner by trade?
Yeah, a couple different names. Yeah, wealth manager, financial advisor, financial planner. All that's pretty much the same thing. Just with different emphasis on what people want to get out of their sessions and is how I can help them in different ways. So,
and you've always been pretty good with your money. Definitely better than I was after school. And we can talk about some of the silly investments that I got involved in. And you luckily managed to stay out of mostly, definitely not to the degree that I did. But it's kind of perfect because I was talking to one of my clients, Maddie, earlier today, and I was driving down here to San Diego, and we were just talking in the car, and Maddie, I'm going to share about your shit. Cool? Maddie is making about $3,500 or so a month, and he doesn't pay rent. The company he works for is a vacation rental company. And he basically lives like a nomad in New York City, jumping from apartment to apartment. But he makes $3,500 a month, doesn't have to pay rent. And after we kind of crunch the numbers, it looks like, he's paying currently around $1,500 a month for food. He pays a few hundred for this group every month. He pays, just some bullshit odds and ends. So we calculated that his monthly nut is roughly $2,000. He makes $3,500. So he's putting $1,500 like in his pocket every month, which is great living in New York City. That's really not easy to do because rent is such a huge expense, but obviously he has that covered. So we were kind of brainstorming some ways like that he could lower his cost. And one way we talked about was $1,500 a month spent on food is pretty pricey. We talked about doing meal preps, which is what I've been doing recently, which means you cook all your food on Sunday, you put it in little Tupperware boxes, you spend about $100 a week at Trader Joe's on the groceries, probably $125, $150 because shit's more expensive in New York. And then you have food for, almost the entire week, and you have a few meals where you can eat out, call them cheat meals. But you don't have to think about food. You don't have to think about cooking. You save a shitload of money because you're not eating every meal and you're getting healthier. So we basically, if we're going to use Maddie as kind of like our test dummy, let's take him. So that's kind of the outline.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Good. You already kind of stole my thunder a little bit on the first topic that you jumped in and already have a expense worksheet or something of that nature. But no, that's good. The first thing when I'm dealing with different clients, if they're just getting started or they're trying to figure out where do I begin, it definitely is looking at sort of a household balance sheet. And so if you run it like a company, you have to know all your expenses and all your income. And so if you have, the first space to look at your income, is it, typical working for a corporation where you have a steady paycheck, does it fluctuate? Do you own your own business? Figuring that out, but trying to get to a number that you can count on a monthly basis so that we can have some place to start as far as cash flow coming in. You have to factor in if you're paying taxes or what tax rates you're in. And then you can get, you have your net income coming in. And then, you have to sit down and look at an expense sheet and categorize all your expenses going back out. And the first step is to make sure that the net income has to be higher than the expenses. And so
And I bet there's a lot of people that think they're making more.
Yeah.
And they're actually in the red, right?
Yeah, especially people that have varying income from either, you know, they own their own business or they work on commissions or things like that, where they'll have a huge month and they'll, you know, sort of in their mind, they'll say, oh, I made, you know, 20 grand, 25 grand this month. And, you know, it's sort of morphs how they're really their perception of what they make, because they don't really factor in that they will have three zeros leading up to that or something like along those lines.
Right.
So it doesn't always have to be that extreme, but yeah, you do have to sit down and, you know, look at what your tax returns were last year or what you're on pace for this year. We're closing on the end of the year, so your year to date for the whole year, and really be honest with yourself and factor in everything. Like you said, Rob, is looking at paying your taxes comes off that gross income, and then you have to look at all your expenses and make sure that you're step one in the positive before we go down any areas of investing or managing your money. If you have a negative number, we don't need to have any discussion about how to handle your money. You need to get that taken care of first.
Right. Yeah, for me, you know, up until I was telling Maddie earlier, up until maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I was like, pretty much broke. I didn't have any debt, but I maybe had like a few thousand bucks in the bank. And I was working for myself, obviously. You know, I was doing this, I was, you know, still running IC, but it was, you know, the business hadn't evolved very much. It was kind of like still like an early stage startup. And I was just basically like just living on whatever came in every month. You know, some months would be great and I'd make five figures. Other months I might make 2 or 3 grand and, you know, certainly spend a lot more than that.
It happens. The credit card bill just like comes in.
Yeah.
And then that's it. One good thing too, let me, you know, interrupt here real quick, is like we talked about, is getting a really good handle on what is coming in as far as your income, is also being honest about what goes out. I mean, we all can sit here and say, yeah, I'm going to spend only $100 at Trader Joe's on food or whatever for this week. And if you let yourself slip and don't at least be honest and look at it, you know, if you go out and grab drinks and you drop a couple $100 at the bar and you're not counting that anywhere,
yeah,
you know, that sneaks up on you.
It does. The spur of the moment bottle service at 1:15 when the bar closes at 2 is never a good look.
No,
definitely made that mistake a few times. You get the credit card statement a few days later. Oh, I spent $300 to drink alcohol and
not sure that you experience the full value of that.
But people do that shit all the time. And so one thing that I got, I think it was like 4 years ago, I had no way of really tracking my spending. Like I knew I had access to my online bank accounts and my credit card statements and everything, but I didn't have like a centralized location where I could, you know, have that where I could see everything. So I downloaded the app Mint, and it's a free app and I think it's great. I can look at it, you know, anytime I want to see exactly how much cash I have, where my investments are, how much I spent yesterday, what I spent on groceries last month, what I spent on alcohol last week. It like automatically doubles that shit for you. And I'm sure there's other apps like that too. Do you have any that you recommend?
I've been using Mint actually myself and with other clients in the same spot. So I think that's a great place to start. If you don't have anything yet in place, definitely start that up. It's very easy. Like Robbie said, it's free to download and it links with bank accounts, credit cards, investments. So you can start off simple. If you don't have a huge portfolio built up yet, you can just put your bank and your credit cards, so you see the inflows and outflows. Mm-hmm. If you do have a lot of investments, you can add those in there as well. So you can go very basic or go more in depth depending on where you are sort of in your investing stage.
Yeah. And for me, that was cool because I could just see everything.
Yeah.
Like I could log in and you can see exactly where everything is. And you know how much credit card debt you have. You know how much money is in your bank account. And it's crazy because like, you know, I've had any time I've like, you know, gotten serious with any sort of girl, any sort of like a girlfriend, I always help her manage her finances and, you know, be like, hey, babe, download this app. No, I don't want to know. I don't want to see it. I don't want to know. It's like, if I could just sweep it under the rug, that it doesn't exist. Like,
I was going to say, yeah. And then the other thing is your Mint account probably started going down when that happened as well, right?
Of course. But it's really really important to have that awareness, because you can't change anything that you're not conscious of. So if you don't know how much money you fucking have, then it's really hard to make more. And you won't really know, like, at what rate you're making more, or how you're doing. So first things first, if you don't have that, fucking get it right away. Like, get some way to track everything you spend. You know, you don't have to be like a super nerd about it, but you just need to know. You should be able to figure out what your net worth is within, what, a minute of looking?
Yeah, if you use something like that app and you don't have too many complex investments at this point in time, you can get everything in there and get answers.
Yeah.
Instantly, yeah.
So let's go back to the Maddie example. So we decided that Maddie's spending roughly $2,000 a month. His income is $3,500. We didn't factor in taxes, which is something important that we forgot. And now Maddie, right now, I think, yeah, I know that Sensei isn't on payroll. We're soon to be on payroll. So your taxes are being, you have to declare them at the end of the year. You're getting 1099, right?
Yes, I believe so.
But coming up, probably starting in 2016, you'll be on payroll. So those will be automatically deducted. So do you have any advice for people that are 1099 versus withheld?
So yeah, 1099, you have to be more diligent. You are on your own. And there's certain self-employment taxes that you have to pay. And so if you don't withhold anything and then you go to your tax professional to help you with your taxes, or you do your own taxes, and say TurboTax or one of those software tools, if you put it in there and you say that you're 1099 versus a W-2 employee, there are certain differences, and there's a couple other things that you might not know that you have to pay. So it's important to put something aside for that. And if this is the first year that you're on a 1099, then you should definitely talk to at least some sort of tax professional in this year to kind of get you started, so that you know next year what you need to put aside, because it's much easier to do it either monthly or quarterly than have to come up on April 15th and write a check to the IRS, which is no fun. And, you know, then it leads to people asking for extensions and paying interest and late fees and other things like that. And so it just kind of snowballs in the wrong direction. So you definitely want to know what to expect. Again, like Robbie said earlier, on your income and your expenses, this is just another expense that you need to know, and you need to recognize it. Otherwise, you won't be able to manage it, and then that's going to be a bill that you're not going to want to pay.
Right. So like in Maddie's situation, Maddie, you let's just, for to make the math easy, let's say you've been making $3,500 since last January, right? And you haven't paid a dime in taxes, correct?
Correct.
So you're going to be hit with a tax bill for, what's that going to be, for whatever percentage of 42,000
is your gross. Not up on New York's exactly on the state. It's probably similar to California. So you're probably looking at like 20% between federal and state. It's a very rough place to start. I mean, you can look at the tax tables. You just Google 2015 tax tables and it's everywhere. So
he's going to be hit with a bill for $8,400. Come what, April 15th.
Right. And really technically supposed to be paying them quarterly if you're 1099 self-employed. So there is some interest due, because the IRS says that July 15th, October 15th, and then January 15th, you are supposed to be making payments leading up to it.
Right.
Whereas, you know, the normal W-2 and salary employee has it deducted directly from the paycheck. So it's sort of taken care of for them. 1099 employee needs to kind of do that on their own. So
Maddie, how does that change the conversation, or what shit has opened up in a new light since hearing that? revolver.
the noose is being strung up as we speak.
Yeah.
And it may be less because of the other expenses, but, you know, like it could.
And like you said, you're owed a decent amount of money. And can't you also claim expenses?
There will, yeah, like I said, there will be other expenses.
Yeah.
I mean, the housing's already paid for, so you're not getting like a housing write-off. You could probably still claim a renter's credit, but that, I don't know. CPAs would have to answer that for you. But there are definitely other deductions, so you'll get some things off of that. I mean, and the other thing is, too, I mean, on the topic of investing and saving, the one big thing that we haven't discussed yet is kind of what to do with the money. If you are in a position where you look at your income, you look at your expenses, you have some money left over, what do I do with it? You definitely want to first build up, you know, just a savings account for a rainy day. You lose your job, you get injured, something happens. You definitely want to have.
And I've heard like a 2-month cushion is kind of what you want to aim for.
Yes, it's 2 to 3 months if your job is steady, or if you're in a relationship where there's a partner that can help out with some of the bills. Typically, you want to have more 4 to 6 months if you're the primary breadwinner or your job is uncertain, that kind of thing.
You work for yourself.
You work for yourself. Yeah. So those are just sort of a rule of thumb that you want to have some money in savings. But once you've got a little savings there, we feel like rainy day, shit comes up, that kind of thing, you would be able to cover things on with that with just money in a savings account. Then you're going to want to look to other tax-efficient vehicles to put a few dollars away. And I mean, this is something you can start as small as $50 a month or as much as, you know, $5 million, you know, what, or anything in between. But once you've already decided that there's some money you want to put away, if you work for a company, well, they probably have a 401k plan set up. If you're 1099, you need to look to set that up yourself. So you can do certain programs that are, you know, just a regular IRA for a business owner, also 1099, you can do what's known as a SEP IRA. And this is just a self-employed pension. So
these are all tax-free retirement accounts, right?
Correct. So like, so pre-tax, right? It's on the way in, it's taxed, you get a tax write-off. So on that other,
and you don't see that money that bypasses your bank account and goes straight into one of these accounts. You don't have to think about it.
Correct.
Ideally, right?
Ideally. Yes.
So. Yeah. So when I first got out of college, I was working for Rinaldi and we set up a 401k and I think a Roth IRA. And my employer would match the 401k. Does that sound right? So certain amount, like let's say I would contribute, I don't know, 500 to it, then the company would also contribute 500 to that.
Yeah, they'll typically match anywhere in these days from 2 to 5% of your salary once you already put that money in.
And then I also had a Roth IRA, which I'm not exactly sure what that is, but I know I can contribute up to $5,000 a year, I think.
So the $5,500 down.
Okay.
So the difference, so the SEP IRA, the 401k, the traditional IRA, pension plans, all of those are tax-deferred vehicles. The way that tax benefits you is that in the year that you earn it, every dollar that you put into it, you are not taxed in this year. So in your example where someone makes $42,000, if they put $5,000 into this account, they'd only pay tax on $37,000. That five just gets wiped straight into the investment account, and you don't pay any tax on it. Now it grows and grows and grows, and when you turn age 59 and a half, and, or you retire, then you access it, you pay tax at that time.
You do pay tax.
You do pay tax on that. But you've been able to defer it, and you can, I mean, there's pretty simple spreadsheets that show you doing this versus doing nothing. You build, you know, 3 or 4 times the amount of money that you have by paying tax and earning money on it, paying tax again.
You're letting it grow and compound.
Correct.
Okay.
Then the opposite end, the exact opposite, what you mentioned, Robbie, was the Roth IRA. The Roth IRA works the exact opposite as a traditional IRA. In the year that you put money in, you get no tax break. But instead of just, say, putting it in your Vanguard Fidelity account or at the bank, it now is in a tax-free wrapper, so all growth is tax-free.
Okay.
Meaning you could put in $1,000 today and buy a small company that takes off, you know, whatever, Google, the next Google, whatever it is, and you could turn $1,000 into $1 billion and pay literally no tax.
If it's in the Roth IRA.
In the Roth IRA.
Okay.
So you see a tax break now on the traditional IRA or 401k, you see a tax break later on the Roth IRA.
Got it.
But both of them give you much
more growth potential than just putting money into your bank.
Yeah.
Or into just a straight investment that's non-retirement related.
Okay. So, and I want to take a volunteer to kind of go in the hot seat, and we can deal with your finances and see what you should do. So if you want to volunteer for that, I'll call on people in a second. But so far we've covered like a standard guy. We're using Matty as an example, who, you know, he makes more money than he spends each month. You know, he has to account for taxes. Starting next year, I think the company is going to automatically take, you know, he's going to be a salaried employee, so he's going to have a W-2. They're going to take that out. And he's going to be in the situation where he has some leftover funds. He can funnel some into a retirement account or something like that. And then he's going to have other money to play with, right? And that's when you have other investment vehicles that you can play with. It's like we talk about in the group, all the different ways where you can invest in the sharing economy and make money off Airbnb. If you want to get an apartment, make money off renting out cars, make money out of fucking walking dogs, right? All these different silly ways you can make money. But you have to have a little bit of money, and you need some capital to do that. So there's a million ways you can make that money work for you. But is there anything else that we need to cover just on like a basic standpoint, financial side, before we find someone to be in the hot seat?
No, I mean, we covered the steps. It's the balance sheet with income and expenses. And then step two is making sure that you have the emergency fund or savings account. And then step three is looking for tax benefits. And then step four is kind of where you're going is, bigger level. If you already have assets built up, we don't know. Obviously, I don't know everyone's situation here. If you're more than just getting started, if you already have money built up, then that's what you look to do, other vehicles and other investments.
Okay. So who wants to have their shit broken down? Who wants us to eat your shit?
I had no idea you guys were so professional.
Highly, highly professional. I know Sherbeezy was just about to buy a house. That could be an interesting one. Sherbeezy, do you want to have any interest in going on the hot seat for this?
Sure.
All right. So if we're going to break yours down, give us the numbers.
What numbers are you interested in?
What do we need, Duck?
So you mentioned that he was looking to buy a house. I mean, is this where, I guess, and I didn't like prep this with Robbie, so I don't know where we're going with this hot seat exactly, but
yeah,
if
I don't know where we're going either.
I guess the first thing is just to tell us where you are along in the process. I mean, it sounds like if you're ready to buy a house, you already have some savings built up. Do you have other investments? You know, what's
your level of- So you were talking about, when I came in, you guys were talking about like sites. I started with Mint. And now I use this site called Personal Capital, which I find better for Mint, because Mint is kind of more like tracking your expenditure. Personal Capital has that, but it does a much better job of tracking your investments. Mint's kind of crappy at that. And also Mint kind of has a hacky homegrown integration with a bunch of financial institutions. Like, for example, it couldn't connect with my savings account, whereas Personal Capital can. So I kind of like it better than Mint. I don't know what you guys were using as an example, but that's a really good way to like check out your net worth and, you know, day-to-day status of pretty much your cash in, cash out. Okay, so that's perfect. What I use. So let me just pull that up. As far as like, I mean, the house, it was, so I was like the standard down payment amount is, usually 25% of the asking price. And then, you know, if you're in a hot market, like LA, you usually have to go over the asking price. So, in this particular offer, I offered 30% down payment, which is like about $270K. And I have a spreadsheet that kind of, I listed in the thread with the house, but basically with that down payment, it comes down to just mortgage, principal and interest payments would be about $3,000 a month. And then if you add on HOA, insurance and property tax, it's like $4,400 a month. And that's like right at the limit of affordability for housing in general is, shouldn't exceed base case scenario is like one third of your, income, kind of more lenient scenario is 44% of your income. And this would definitely be pushing the, more lenient, leaner 44% of my income. So those are those numbers. I don't know what else you're interested in.
Yeah.
No, as far as like retirement, like, I try to contribute the max, which is like, I think it's like $17,000, a year. I'm fortunate enough to have like a pretty generous matching, but I'm pretty sure most companies have some sort of matching, and it's just kind of foolish not to do it if your company has matching, because it's kind of like throwing away free money. And I've been saving up for a while, and I would say probably like, I don't know, a little under half of my net worth is in tax-free retirement stuff. So I guess I'm further along than most people, but then again, I'm probably older than most people on this call too. So.
Perfect. So the real estate that you're looking into, it's not for primary residence. You're looking to rent it
No. It's definitely for primary residence. It would be like I'd rent it out on vacations or occasionally. Like if I was just looking at it for a cash cow, I wouldn't even buy it. I'd probably just do what you guys are doing.
Sure. Yeah. Well, yeah. And then we look at different things. There's some things that, you know, you can own and put on Airbnb, and then there's some things that you want to rent or whatever it may be. But, that's good. I mean, you covered some of the main things, like you talked about, you know, the lender is going to keep you to, you know, if anyone's looking to buy real estate, not just a rule of thumb, but what you actually talked about, the lender's not going to let you go more than, you know, 44, 45% maximum. And they're going to count every bill that you have against you from.
Exactly. They do a very thorough kind of like evaluation of your take home. Like you got to show pretty much all your assets and like your W-2 and your pay stubs and two or 3 months worth of statements. It's pretty, yeah, they do a pretty extensive job to make sure that you can assume that loan. Yeah.
Especially on what your job is, you know, if you are pay sub W-2, it's a much easier for the lenders to give you an exact amount. And then if you're 1099 or you own your own business, they're going to want to ask, you know, a few other questions. If you own businesses and you have Schedule K ones that you're going to have to provide and business taxes. So yeah, they definitely dig in, and their job, the underwriter's job, is to basically try and mash down your income as much, you know, look for any indiscrepancies or look for anything that, you know, irregularities, and sort of eliminate income and be as conservative as possible. Since 2008, obviously the lending space has changed a great deal. The banks really gave out loans to pretty much anybody based off of credit. And they really pulled back. So yeah, now when you're trying to apply, they're definitely going to look at all your income and your assets, and then make sure that you're not inflating any numbers. And then they're going to look at all your bills, from car payments to, they'll even look at, like when they do look at your pay stubs, if you have a 401k loan, they'll count that payment against you, and they'll look at everything so that that they're not overextending you. So it's good, right? That obviously they're able to go through that and be fine.
Yeah. And in addition to that, they also want to make sure that you have like a bit of buffer left over, because in addition to the whole down payment, there's also like closing costs. Like in my case, closing costs conservatively could be $15,000. And then you want to make sure after all that, you still have some buffer left over. So it's right. Not if you're like expending every last cent on just the down payment, you have nothing left over. That's still not going to get approved.
Not a good sign. And wouldn't want to be in that position, obviously.
Exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, it's like it's a little invasive, but after evaluating a little bit more, it's actually for your own benefit. Like, you wouldn't want to be, you know, have like zero safety net between you and like, you know, living right on the street. So it's actually a good thing.
Number, like, let's say, I don't know, just for, to use an example, all right, let's say I'm 35, saying I'm a random guy. I don't know. I have, what's a normal amount of money in a 401k at like 35, you know, 100 grand, 50 grand,
100 grand,
100 grand, right? And I've been renting my whole life, right? Maybe I have, fuck, I don't know, another 100 grand parked in like a bank account or something.
Sure.
Is that like a, give me like an idea of someone like a normal run of the mill guy who's like smart enough to get a job. He has a job. Okay. He's never bought a house. Like, what the fuck should he do with this cash he's sitting on? You know, 'cause there's so many things you can do with it.
Right.
What would be like a normal sort of number standpoint? What do people want to aim for? What's like a benchmark?
Right. Well, and then the big question is what their lifestyle goal comes down to. I mean, I have the question, obviously, is this for primary residence? You know, a lot of people are starting right out of college. Like, one of the big things they will look is, you know, I feel like I'll make it if I buy a house, right?
Like, I'm fucking retarded.
I want to get there, right? Yeah. But it's like programmed in our minds. It's the American dream.
Yeah.
You got to get the picket fence, 1.5 dogs. It's like perfect, you know? So you want to get to a spot, if that's your goal though, then yeah, you need to save, like we discussed, depending on your market, LA, San Diego, New York. I mean, you name, you know, pretty hot markets for real estate right now. So you're going to have to come in with at least, you mentioned 30%, but yeah, at least 20% down, for most of these purchases. But you're going to want to have cushion, like we talked about, because the worst thing going in is if you don't have much money there left over and then you get behind on your payments, you already made a down payment, you sort of got into your home that you're excited about, you know, you furnish it, do nice things, and then if you have to sell or lose the house, it's obviously a terrible investment. So you're definitely going to want to figure out, you can calculate that. You look at the type of house you're looking for in whatever market you're in, look at the asking prices, look at what's sold. You can use, I mean, luckily now there's tons of great resources like Zillow, Redfin. So you look at these housing places and not only can you see what's available, but you can also see what's been sold. So that's also a pretty good indicator of what the people can list for whatever they want to list. And some people are more overzealous in what they think they're going to get for their house. And then some houses stay on the market for a long time. But if you look at what actually has sold and what actual prices have gone for, you can get a good idea of the area you're looking in. And then obviously multiply that by 20%. Or 25%, and you know what you have to come up with the down payment. There are some other programs out there that let you have a little bit lower down payment, but you're going to then want to make sure that you're have a better buffer on the lenders call it debt to income ratio, which is going back to that payment that you're acquiring versus how much income is coming in. So you have to have one or two. If you have a lot of assets to back it up and have down payment, have a cushion. Or if you're, you know, if you're making $300,000 a year and your housing cost is only going to be, you know, $2,000 a month, there's a lot of cushion on that side. So you either need a cushion on the income side or on the asset side. But depending on your market, you look at 20% down is a good amount down. So you do need to save that. And hopefully you can do it outside of your retirement plan, because the retirement plan is supposed to be for just that retirement. We don't know where Social Security is going to be when, you know, the 30, the 35, the 25 year old on this phone call, whatever that may be. Social Security may change over the next, you know, 20, 25 years before we start taking it. So that's not something to rely on. Pensions have kind of gone by the wayside by employers. So your retirement asset that you have in a 401k or IRA may be a huge portion, if not the entire thing, that you have to rely on in retirement. So we try and steer people away from using that completely for their down payment. keeping that for what it's meant to be, which is actually retirement.
Got it. Sherbon, did you have any other questions regarding the situation?
Just some add-ons to Justin's point about how much you should have saved for retirement. The site I mentioned, Personal Capital, has a good kind of simulator for how much you'll have based off of your current assets, expected growth for those assets, and like current contributions to your 401k. And it takes into account Social Security at different ages. So you'll see like what your monthly income will be simulated in retirement, kind of gives you like, you know, guide points. And then as far as what you should invest in, Jesse and Max had a couple of threads, really good threads, a couple months earlier about this topic. And I think the general wisdom these days is don't go for mutual funds, go for like low cost ETFs or robo bankers, I think they're called. I use one called Betterment that's pretty good. It just basically invests in like the market as a whole, or there's like ETFs for pretty much most of the major indices like the S&P 500. I mean, it's cool and sexy to, you know, pick a hot company, and, you know, everyone does that. And especially sometimes it makes sense. But if you don't know what the hell you're doing, it's just good to just choose a vehicle that just tracks like the market on the whole. And ETFs or robo bankers are a good and very cheap way to do that. But the problem with most mutual funds is like they have a very targeted investment strategy, and they usually have like pretty high fees. And it's proven that most of the time, like no matter how smart or well-informed you are, no, humans rarely just beat the market as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like 80 something percent of mutual funds underperform the benchmark. So you're pretty much guaranteed to pay to lose.
Yep, exactly.
All right, cool. So who else on the call wants any sort of questions or any sort of, you guys have any advice that you guys want before we dive into some other stuff? What else do we need to cover?
Did we get it all? I mean, you covered a lot of good things. I mean, there's a couple other things out there that in addition to, if you really want to dive into actual investments, there's some other things out there above and beyond just like ETFs and just the market that a lot of companies are coming out with to help combat basically the mutual fund battle that you talked about. And also banks are losing lots of money from CDs. So there's a couple of things that JP Morgan has done and some other places that have structured things using some hedges and some options where they're going to actually give you some protection in the market. So for those people that have already built up some assets, where you're not as concerned with making tons and tons of return, you're more concerned of steady growth and not losing what you've already built. There's some other good ways to look into that. But it just, again, it depends on where the person's at. You know, if we're going back to the original example was, I need to figure out a budget, you know, they're so far away from that. But if you already have that down and you have some of your other things in place and you have your 401k and your IRAs, things like that, then it's looking at more in depth of what to actually invest that in. So, yeah, I mean, look, cost is one thing, but also value of what you're getting. You know, is there any protection? Is there any strategy for, maintaining your assets, even if the market is choppy or if interest rates rise, or a lot of different things that are out there.
Yeah.
And then also, I mean, then there's alternative things to look into, real estate and other things that are not just tapping into the stock market or bond market, which is sort of the traditional investing.
Okay.
Looking at different alternatives. And there's investments that companies will bring you into, which are bank loans or real estate, or you can also go out and do things on your own. Like you mentioned, obviously the Airbnb and certain things you've gotten into that can be utilized through renting and re-renting it out, but also can be utilized for owning property and actually using Airbnb and VRBO and the other places to make a return on that as well. So kind of combines the traditional investing and investing in something like a real estate asset with some of the new sharing economy kind of combines both worlds into that. So there's a lot of things to look at. It's just a matter of where you're at sort of in your journey.
Yeah. So it's basically what you're saying. It's all very case dependent.
Very, yeah,
a certain level.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, cool. All right, guys. Well, any other questions?
Anything else we have to cover?
Good length for a podcast. 45 minutes. All right. Peace out.
Fuck you.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for coming on, Brian. All right. See you guys.